Good afternoon, ANAE members, and welcome to the ANAE Learning Series webinar. My name is Anna McCormick, and I'm the product manager for ANAE. Before we get started, I just have two announcements. We've got our first in-person meeting December 1st and 2nd at the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport Marriott. Confirmed systems that will be speaking include Midland Health, CHC, Premier, Texas Health Resources, United Regional Healthcare System, and more. So be sure to get on the ANAE website and reserve your spot at the discounted member rate, and we hope to see you in December. We have a guest speaker. John Pritchard actually had to jump on a last minute meeting. So we are lucky to have Ken Morawski, president of Healthcare Links, interviewing our guest speaker today, who is Amanda Chawla, Chief Supply Chain Officer, Vice President at Stanford Healthcare. Thank you so much, Ken and Amanda, for being here with us today.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it, Anna. And Amanda, thanks so much. Thanks so much for joining us. Excited to have this interview with you. We saw each other last, I think, at Federation, where you were on a panel there, and I introduced the panel. You've been in the news a lot this year, and probably less with the pandemic and all the things you've done at Stanford, all the great things you've done. In fact, the Journal of Healthcare Contracting recognized you as the Contracting Professional of the Year. So that's pretty special.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you, Anna. It's a privilege to be here, and it's an honor to speak with the group and really share our perspective.
I guess the best place to start is to have you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got to Stanford, and we'll start there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I always start off with, I'm not necessarily your traditional supply chain executive. My career has not always been in supply chain, but it has always been in healthcare. And so the perspective that I bring is really from the front line. It's from the clinical side. It's from running hospital operations, clinic operations, and really a multitude of different things. Prior to joining Stanford, I was in a chief kind of operating officer type of function and running a number of divisions from the OR to cardiac, PT, EBS, food services, supply chain, you name it. And I'd been doing that for a number of years. And at that point, I had really gotten burnt out and I was pregnant with my first child. I know I needed to take a break. So I actually ended up at Stanford by accident. I wasn't active. When I interviewed at Stanford, I was pretty direct in my interview process that I was very pregnant, and I wasn't necessarily sure that I would be at Stanford for very long. Now, you know, fast forward 5 years, now with three kids, I look back and I laugh at my naive self and I go, you know, I absolutely love what I do, love the team, the people, the organization. And in fact, I often think and reflect that I'm probably working harder than I ever did before because I'm so passionate on the need to transform, not only at Stanford, but I think healthcare supply chain as an industry. And when we think about supply chain, I really think about us as a supply network and really changing the narrative and the conversation to a supply network, because our success, our work is so interdependent. So that's what excites me. That's what keeps me going at Stanford, as well as where I am in my career.
Wow, that's a great introduction. I didn't realize you had so many other jobs, so to speak, or so many other departments that you're affiliated with, because that's a great background, especially at a complex place like Stanford. Amazing. And 5 years and three kids. I saw that one most recently, I have a feeling. That's amazing that you can juggle all those things together. I guess, as far as the supply chain department, it is a little bit different. Supply chain network, an interesting way to put it. Tell us how your department is organized, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so supply chain at Stanford is really organized with what I would call a functional structure and a dyadic partnership. We've probably gone through two major reorg in the 5 years that I've been there. And probably a third one that will come up, I'm sure, in a year, as I think about the chess moves. But really, the org structure is really across four divisions. We have our logistics arm, we have our procure to receive arm, we have our systems and analytics arm, and we have our business transformation arms. The logistics and distribution includes our traditional warehousing and kind of the logistics operations around the movement of products and goods across the hospitals, across the clinics, across the various sites. Our procure to receive arm includes our basic sourcing, category management, purchasing, supplier diversity, but it also includes our receiving arm. And you might argue, well, receiving is logistics. Yes, it's logistics, but it's also procure to pay. And so from a strategic standpoint, we put receiving under the procure to receive arm. Our systems and analytics arm includes kind of the concepts of demand planning. We're now looking into the concept of a central control tower, our data management. And our very last arm is really our business transformation. And that was a net new function that I created in supply chain, where we brought in resources for training, for communication, financial management, process improvement, project management. And so in that arm, I really have kind of a chief of staff type of role. And that actually supports across the continuum of the supply chain. So philosophically, the way that we've got the org structure is everyone's got their functional responsibilities, but there's this theory or there's this really interwoven aspect of communication and collaboration across the various divisions. The best example that I could probably provide to you is it's similar in concept to service line leadership. And so when you think about that, you have pace setters of policies and procedures and directions. And even if you look at, for example, in logistics, we have multiple hospitals, we have multiple locations. We have, you know, a leader that may report under the traditional org structure hierarchy, but that same leader would probably be a pace setter for our inventory management policies that cross over. So that's how we've broken up the overall kind of at a high level, the structure of supply chain.
Yeah, I see one of the key components of that is communication, right? Getting people to talk to each other, and you have so many potential silos, they really need to communicate well between each other. I was curious, one of the big buzzwords these days is value analysis, right? Mm-hmm. Value analysis organization. Where does that fit in your organization? And you also talk a lot about the clinically integrated supply chain, which is a big goal, I believe, of yours. Talk mm-hmm. to that, if you would, Amanda.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Our value analysis structure fits within the procurement arm, the procure to receive arm. And really at Stanford, we call it value-based selection, but we are moving away from the concept of value analysis and value-based selection to reframing the group to what we're calling value-based management. So as a structure, we have our committees are really enterprise-wide. So they're across Stanford Medicine. Our multiple entities. We have physician-based and physician-led committees that are supply chain supported. And within the physician committee, we have an adult focus, we have a pediatric focus. And within that committee, there's actually subcommittees, which are really service line focused. And so we may have, you know, a service line focus around orthopedics. So we bring our orthopedic physicians together. They eventually report into our overall governing committee. For general kind of nursing supplies and ancillary products, we have an enterprise nursing value analysis committee. Generally, what we do is we have one physician chair from each organization and one ACNO, assistant chief nurse operating chair, on the nursing committee for each organization. And so the chairs actually run the committee, but they're heavily, heavily supported by our supply chain category management team. We don't have a value analysis coordinator. And the reason for that in our concept and theory is we want the right category manager supporting the work on the value analysis committee. So if it's orthopedic, it'll be our CM for orthopedic that will support that work. If it's neuro, it'll be our CM that supports that work. And so when you really think about that structure, it is really intentionally across the enterprise. It's intentionally clinically led. And I talked about we're moving away from value analysis, value-based selection to what we're calling value-based management. And I want to talk maybe just a minute about why it is moving towards that direction and what that means, getting to your question, Ken, the clinically integrated supply chain. And so really, you know, when we look at the CQO movement, it's really for us about bringing cost, quality, and outcomes together. And while we may do a great job on product selection and benchmarking and reviewing the products, we don't do such a great job actually then reflecting or reviewing and understanding how is this product now used? Is it actually helping with the quality aspects? Is it really helping reduce length of stay or reduce OR times or whatever the product is intended to do? And so by changing the focus of the committee from value-based selection to value-based management, we not only change the focus of new product selection, but when new products are selected and brought forward, they're brought forward in a lens of what we'll call procedural analytics, where we understand the consumption and really the value proposition. So that's one of our key priorities and reasons for why we're going from a VBS to a VBM program. The second, I would say, element is as we think about a clinically integrated supply chain, Stanford has really taken the HIMSS seven stages model to a degree where we're embedding that framework and those elements into our value equation and into how we operate. So whether that's with our VBS, VBM program that we're in the midst of transitioning to, or whether it's our day-to-day clinical operations or dealing with substitutes, we're really adopting the seven stages and putting a plan in place that will help us become more clinically integrated. And clinically integrated can mean many different things, from structured committees and programs, such as in the value analysis world, to how we operate the day-to-day, to how we handle the reliability or the immunity of the supply chain, to how we service the healing hands that care for the patient.
Mm-hmm. That's a mouthful. What's really intriguing to me is the way that you talk about management, and I've been in the industry a long time and over 30 years in national accounts. So I've seen value analysis. I've seen standards. I started out seeing standards committees that can become at least in words value analysis, mm-hmm. but the management piece of it, I don't think very many people at all look back on what the decisions they've made and whether or not products have been overutilized, where they had certain expectation, or and look back and said, wow, this is actually costing us a lot more than we ever thought. Mm-hmm. So that's really progressive.
Yeah. And for us, what I would say is, you know, thinking about Stanford as an AMC, a part of our core DNA is innovation. And so we sometimes bring products on board for off use or for other intended purposes. And so there's a whole quality aspect of, is this product providing the value or the attributes it's intended to do? Is there a value proposition? And can we measure that as well as the cost and the variation component? Because we all have heard about standardized order sets and standardized XYZ. And for us, the motto that we have in our program is, it's not about reducing rational variation. What we're talking about is the irrational variation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially on the pandemic products. I don't want to get into that right now, but that was an aberration with N95s, you know, using, everybody had an N95 all of a sudden, that, you know, 20 times the cost. But
yeah,
in light of that, with the value analysis, what about a new technology introduction? And is that a part of that process as well?
It is lightly touched on in our value-based, our value-based selection program. Mm-hmm. We have not yet formalized, I would say, a structure on technology alone. We think it's really integral to the products we purchase and not necessarily a completely separate function. And so we don't separate out the technology piece. We think it's all part of how products are used.
Okay. Tell us about the little switch and the GPO relationship that you have. and whether or not you participate in any other groups or peer networks or regional aggregation groups?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So we do partner on GPO opportunities from a what we would say that provide value from a clinical and a supply chain perspective. Mm-hmm. That's where we see the greatest partnership on the GPO side is when our GPO can not only provide us the supply, the provider, the contracting aspects, but really integrate with our clinicians and on the clinical side. And so, you know, I think I mentioned the word procedural analytics, but there's a huge, what I would say, an integration standpoint. The other aspect of our partnership and GPO is really around the Stanford Pacific programs. We have what we call a non-labor spend program. And so our GPO really partners with us on an annual basis and on a regular basis in not only identifying opportunities, but helping us execute those opportunities. And some of you may be wondering, okay, well, what's non-labor spend? Our philosophy here at Stanford is supply chain is akin to HR in the sense that HR is a pace setter on the people strategy. And we look at supply chain as kind of the pace center of all non-labor spend. And so with that, that really broadens our scope and our horizon to say it's not just, it's anything that we buy, whether it's a product or service. And so from a GPO relationship standpoint, we actually rely on our GPO quite a bit to partner with us on identifying those opportunities where we have that irrational variation of service products or goods. From a, I would say from a regional aggregation or executive peer network standpoint, we aren't formally involved in a significant amount of any regional aggregation groups. Most of our sourcing work is through what we would call probably informal peer networks. And that's how we're set up today.
And just to clarify, the GPO is Vizient, I presume.
It is Vizient for Stanford, yes.
Just for clarification. And what about, tell me about distribution. Do you do self-distribution or do you rely on a national distributor?
Yeah, so we actually do rely on a national distributor. We have a primary distribution agreement. Mm-hmm. And we've partnered quite heavily with our distributor to navigate what we would call all kind of the supply chain shortages. We've probably forged new pipelines and created new partnership frameworks. At the same time, the reality is like many systems, we're struggling on the reliability of distributed products. And so one of the things that Stanford has done is we have bought our own, what I would call stockpiling mm-hmm. warehouse. That's not our primary activity for supply resiliency, but with that, that has created friction in the way that JIT LUM is managed, because now we've created essentially this warehousing activity that sits outside of our primary distribution workflows. And so we're looking to optimize that with the aim of evaluating the strategic use of a warehouse mm-hmm. Versus the distribution kind of service. Stanford is not large enough to go into self-distribution. We don't have the physical footprint or the scale where that would be a value proposition. And so a lot of our conversations with our distributor has really shifted towards how do we co-partner with this global network of supply, not only in advancing the supply chain, but really how do we get timely communication? How do we get transparency? How do we know when disruptions occur? Because we know they're happening and they're happening at a higher rate than they've ever happened before. What the alternatives are? How can we get that proactive communication? So a lot of our work with the distributor and with the stockpiling warehousing is really based on a set of strategies that we've got and workflows and tools that we're building and reports to go, how do we get ahead of this and get ahead of this together? And if there are products that Stanford has transitioned to or have stockpile, how do we bring them back into our JIT channel? Because the last thing we want is an expired warehouse that's sitting out there outdated.
Right. Like so many others have done in yeah. the past and learned that lesson the hard way. I heard, and maybe you can confirm, that California is requiring stockpiling of supplies, X amount of months of supplies. Is that so?
That is correct. 90 days, and there's a very specific formula that has been discussed and is in play in California that has to do with a certain set of supplies, as well as the quantification of what 90 days is. And so there's absolutely a requirement. And I would say most of those requirements right now are really in the PPE space. When I think about the supplies that had that requirement. And, you know, part of that is that knee-jerk reaction in response to the pandemic. But I also wonder about supply reliability and what level and how we define critical supplies outside of PPE that should be in a stockpile versus products in which we should be looking at other types of sourcing strategies or onshoring, things of that sort.
Yeah. Has there been a change? It makes me think, has the policy maybe globally changed in terms of the number of sources of supply? A lot of people feel that sole source, you're going to get your best price, but we've learned that if you don't have a backup plan, you can be cut short. So do you see a trend toward more multi-source contracts?
I do. I also think it's a little bit of what is a balancing equation. I think you have to go back and take a look at what products do we have and for what purposes and what's the criticality. And so even in a single source, can I use a different product if there was a disruption here? How critical or how secure is this product? Is there conservation? Could we, thinking about sustainable, you know, procurement, sustainability? Could we think about, you know, sustainability? There's a lot that goes in, but I would say in general, I think the knee-jerk reaction has been going from sole source to multi-source, because anybody would say, look, I'd rather have something rather than nothing type of. And so it's a fine balance between what we sole source versus what we strategically diversify, as well as what comes on shore and what we will always probably have some level of dependency offshore is offshore on.
Yeah. It touches on the Made in America piece. If you could talk to that a little bit. Over the years, we've worked with a lot of suppliers that have a story around green initiatives or diversity or Made in USA. But often the providers will say, I want to do all that. I have initiatives around all that, but I can't pay a penny more.
Yep. And I think that's the tension. And it's a natural tension that's faced because when you look at it from a provider's lens and you look at their contribution margin, there's not a lot of wiggle room that allows that ability to spend more. So cost is definitely a part of the equation. It's not going away. I think about it, what we call at Stanford is we've defined it as the sourcing process, and process stands for purchasing reliable. So think of it, this is an equation, purchasing reliable products that are outcomes based with customer coordination. So we understand what the customer requires from equitable and sustainable sources. And in that word, the process, what we debated very heavily on is really, do we put cost there? And we decided that cost is kind of this underlying component that doesn't really go away from the equation. And it wasn't necessarily to bring it forward because it's built into value when you look at cost quality outcomes. And so I think it's going to be a fine balance on what can you afford? Where's the transparency of the cost? We also recognize that everyone's in a business. And with the business, there's a need to make profit, you know, and what that profit is and how it comes together. I think that's where it becomes a little bit of a challenge, but I would say the price part of the conversation doesn't go away.
Yeah, I don't think it'll ever go away, but we appreciate the fact that you're bringing a clinically integrated and outcomes piece of it, because I see so many supply chain people are judged by spending less than they did last year. That's their major barometer. And it's kind of one of my pet peeves is we work with a lot of suppliers who can reduce infections, reduce pressure, surgical slight infections. And yet that's never, you know, unfortunately not factored in often to the your, maybe not you personally, but your the supply chain person's compensation or mission.
Yep. And I would say part of the challenge is the transparency of that, right? So the example that you gave is absolutely right on. And this product may cost less, but it results in one less county infection. Well, right. A county infection will outweigh the total cost for the whole year, you know, but how do we quantify and how do we link the cost of goods to that quality and outcomes piece? And the challenge that we have in healthcare is there isn't very clear tools and data that bring that together without that manual intentional effort.
But it sounds like you've got a lot of IT support behind you, which you talked about earlier in your various departments and initiatives.
Absolutely. I think IT is going to be the core to supply chain and really to our industry in many ways. Data and intelligent analytics out of the data. Not necessarily AI, but I would say the intelligence aspects of data, right? How is that data used? We're almost data rich and analytics poor, right? So there's a lot of data flowing in the ecosystem, but it's making that intelligent and actionable.
Yeah. So bring us up to speed. You went through a lot with the pandemic a while back. How do you feel your Sanford is in respect to that now? And what do you see in the crystal ball in the next 6 months?
If I had a crystal ball, we would be talking about a whole different thing. We've really experienced this uptick of innovation across our industry. And if we haven't recognized yet, I would say we're forever changed, you know, both personal lives and society to our professional experiences. So it's upon us to reflect and really take this as an opportunity to propel the future change, because we are creating the future. We are creating that. And so as I think about that, it's recognized we're not going to go back to normal. It's about how we define that new future normal, and that we can't put a blind eye to the data, to the facts, to the stories, to the experiences that we've collectively had across, you know, the supply chain network. You look at the distributor workforce. I don't know that many members that have been working hybrid or remote will go back into the office full time. We're seeing it outside of the healthcare industry being public, but it's happening in the healthcare industry as well. And so when we think about this, we think about what we've gone through in the last 2 years or so. We also have other things that have happened. You know, we've got this renewed and this sharpened focus on inclusion, diversity, health equity, sustainability. Right. And so there's a lot to unpack there. And so when I think about it from a Stanford viewpoint, it comes back to us taking a step back and thinking about how are we operating? What aspects have operated well? What aspects do we need to refine? What aspects do we need to double down and intentionally do more education or training or process infrastructure on? Mm-hmm. That's where we also sat back and just a couple months ago or less than 2 months ago, I had our end of year fiscal leadership retreat. We did it virtually 2 years in a row, mm-hmm. and it worked. It has worked quite successfully. And with that, we displayed kind of what we're calling vision mission 2022 of supply chain. We reset where we were going at Stanford, at least. And we said, what are our three core pillars? Our three core pillars is purpose, different process. I explained what process was. The second is the acceleration and the need to be clinically integrated because we are in a people business. And it's about people in terms of the work we do. And the third kind of pillar we had is really intra-operational preeminence. We call ourselves the supply chain, but often we act and operate as independent divisions or departments in silos, and doubling down on this theory or this concept, not theory, of integration across our various aspects of supply chain. Mm-hmm. So those are the things that we're doing internally within Stanford. From a community, from a supplier standpoint, you know, the other aspects that we've looked at is how we do our sourcing. So like many hospitals, you know, defining what's single source, what's our sole source, what's not sole source. Mm-hmm. We've got the stockpiling strategy. We've brought an entire resiliency team that's going to double down. We used to have about 300 to 400 disruptions a month. Now we're calculating we have about 600 disruptions a month.
Wow.
And the way that we're defining a disruption at Stanford is anytime a unique product, so it's not the same product, that doesn't come in because of a manufacturer back order, because of a transport delay, because of a recall, anything that disrupts the reliability of the supply chain. And so, you know, how do we double down in our daily standard work into our playbooks, into our dual sourcing, our multi-sourcing strategies, to even our innovations? We kicked off an innovations task force early on in the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And like many hospitals, we're able to come up with our solutions, but how do we embed that now into our DNA? And mm-hmm. so there's a lot of things that have really changed the way that we think from a global perspective, but also the way that we're operating. We're a different supply chain. The one silver lining that I would say that's occurred across the pandemic is really this partnership with our clinicians. Over this past year, we have identified about 990, I think that was the number, new products or alternative products outside of PPE that our clinicians can use. Now that makes up a very small percent of our procurement and our supply chain. But what that's doing for us is it's allowing us to become a more immune, a more healthy supply chain organization by having the strong partnerships with our clinicians and by proactively identifying when a disruption occurs with this product, what can we use? Is there an alternative in the market? Can we do different aspects of utilization management? Can we do reuse? And there's a lot that goes into that, but I think that conversation is not going away. Instead, it's becoming more formal.
That what you just said is really huge, because so many people, and they learned that lesson in the pandemic, that what else can we use? Well, you know, maybe it costs a little more, but we have to have alternatives and not just, you know, all of a sudden run to nursing and say, hey, can we use this instead of that at the last minute? It's very proactive on your part. But, you know, I think a lot of people learn that lesson. Whether or not they follow through on it is a different question. Stanford clearly is unique, isn't it? How do you feel you're unique relative to other places?
Yeah, so there's probably three things that jump out to my mind. Our structure, mm-hmm. the concept of being uniquely Stanford. I'll get into that in a minute. And then third, our people and our teams. Stanford is comprised of multiple legal entities with individual hospital boards. We have our CEOs that don't report to each other. So supply chain is in a unique position in which we operate under the umbrella of Stanford Medicine, but we really have legally different management structures and organization entities. And supply chain provides that corporate service across the different entities. When you combine that and you've got a structure that has an AMC, a community hospital, a children's hospital, it makes things sometimes a little bit challenging because you don't have that central executive reporting element. And so a lot of our work is based on relationships, but it's also based on what's best for Stanford Medicine. The second component, being an academic medical center located at the heart of Silicon Valley, and having the global outreach that we have, where we have, you know, patients that are flown in all around the country, whether it's on our peds or our adult side, for their care, the level of quality, the level of patient experience, the level of innovation is at such a high level. I can't even describe it. So there's a cultural aspect to that. And so how does that translate to supply chain? That means we're going to have a higher product mix. In some areas, we'll probably have lower standardization. So that's why I talk about rational variation versus irrational variation. And sometimes when new products aren't even readily available on the market, we're utilizing them, or we're testing and we're building and we're creating and we're innovating. So that's one aspect of what I think is unique about our health system. The second aspect is really what we call being uniquely Stanford. The term uniquely Stanford is written into our Stanford Medicine Integrated Strategic Plan. Mm-hmm. I think I just mentioned our CEOs don't report into each other, but they work together as collaborators under the Stanford Medicine umbrella. And so they have built that into their strategic plan, into our strategic plan, and defined what that means. And so for supply chain, it's based on this intentional aspect of centering the work that we do around our people at the heart of what we do. So whether it's our structures, whether it's our purposes. And so it's really that approach of the how, and it's that unwavering focus and the design in which we operate. The third aspect is I'll go into our peoples and teams. And this one is probably the one that I'm overly proud of, is we really have an unmatched group of leaders who collaborate and work together to make incredible and tangible improvements in not only how we operate, but how we transform. You know, one of my leaders will say, Amanda, it's not really about out of the box thinking. It's that there is no box. And that's really been something that's been adopted. And so the level of commitment and dedication on the team is bar none. You know, shortly before the pandemic, there was a pretty big issue that we had in the Stanford supply chain that we were impacted at. And the example that, and I give this example because our leadership team, did not matter if their team was directly impacted or not, not only came in, worked 24, 48 hours straight through the night, slept at the hospital floor just to make sure our patients, that there was no disruption in service or care. And so it really is our people that I think make Stanford unique, and supply chain specifically unique, in the sense that it's really a family. You know, we say one team, one dream. It's real and palpable.
Wow. You've done a great job, and kudos to your folks. I know a lot of people have done a lot of things with the pandemic, but I see where you've lauded their efforts, and it all works together. It is a people business, no matter how you slice it. I've got to ask you from a supplier perspective, with all our ANAE folks in the audience, what is access like these days to be able to see people either in the facility or with your group?
Yeah, I'd say access is still limited. And I also think it depends upon the culture in the area in terms of the region where you're at. And the reason why I say that is, at least in Palo Alto and Stanford, we're probably very highly conservative on the COVID risk side, in which not only, you know, in the state of California, I think this is known, are we mandating vaccinations and or accommodations and I'll explain that in a minute, to our employees, but we're also doing that with our suppliers. Over the last probably several months, I can't tell you how many hours and how many meetings I've been at around the conversation of what do we do with our business partners? What do we do with our suppliers? You know, the state is saying that vaccination or accommodations are required. We have a team of highly skilled clinicians, research professionals, and professors and so forth. That really believe that Stanford should set the path. And really it's around the safety of our patient. It's a safety of our patients, our community, our people. Mm-hmm. And so there was intense discussion about, do we mandate that all of our suppliers must be vaccinated? And Stanford, we came out with that mandate, but we said originally, you must be fully vaccinated in order to do business with us, period. And when we say do business with us, we say when you're coming in to our facilities, doesn't matter if it's administrative or clinical, but you're working inside our facilities. It doesn't mean any business outside of the buildings. We started off with that stance, and we quickly realized that may not be tenable because on our employee side, we were providing a level of accommodations. Now our accommodation rate is very, very low at Stanford. And so we changed that stance, and we said to our suppliers that you either must be vaccinated or you must have an accommodation on file with your employers. And so I share that because you asked the question of, well, how easy is it to do? You know, what does it look like now? that we're really in this endemic with COVID and not longer really in this pandemic is what I would say, mm-hmm. is we're still saying, please limit yourself unless it's truly critical or unless you need to be there. We know that business can occur remotely, and we want to continue to encourage that. I also recognize equally that in supply chain, especially when we're talking about value-based selection and value analysis and things of that sort, there's an aspect to seeing things, touching things in person, and there's a people aspect of interacting in person. So I think it's going to be this fine balance as we move forward in the future, in the sense that some business will continue to be virtual and there will be some leveling of on-site engagements and relationships. Are we there yet? Probably not.
No, that's a good way to put it. I was going to ask you that question. Are you mandating, or is Stanford mandating to their employees? That's a sensitive subject. The other piece, I've seen some technology where you could actually have, they talk about the repless OR, where you can actually mm-hmm. have video monitoring that can zoom into the site, and the rep can be virtually there. Mm-hmm. Which is, a great idea. That will change. These are the things that will change the way we do business together, as well as even in services. I guess that I would imagine that doing video in services is just almost as acceptable as in person.
I would definitely say that, Ken. And I think we're seeing that even on as patients. We're all patients of the healthcare system. And, I'm sure that we know somebody in our family or friends that's had a telehealth visit, and we hear statistically about what has occurred on the telehealth side.
Yeah. It's worked. I've had a number of them in it. And
I've had a few for my kids.
I'm sure you have. It's definitely the future. I'm almost run out of questions. I could probably talk to you for another hour, but I know you are extremely busy. But do you have any other things you'd like to share with the audience, understanding it's primarily suppliers at a corporate account level? Anything you'd like to share? And
I'm sorry, I muted myself accidentally. I'd probably like to share and probably end with, the concept of the supply network. And as an industry, I would say we need to push forward for that. And I think this conversation of transparency and trust has probably been doubled down. And so as a supplier, when you're working with providers, I think the more transparent you can be, because we also recognize that you're getting disrupted in many times and in many ways, mm-hmm. is be transparent about that disruption. Come to the table, offer up alternatives and or solutions and or some level of a recommendation. And with that, there becomes greater trust mm-hmm. and greater reliability, or at least a relationship with greater transparency. So I think, part of what is going to be our focus, at least in the foreseeable future, is this doubling down on how we engage together. And so recognizing disruptions that are going to occur, they're on everyone's minds. And as a supplier, when you know that you're being disrupted, communicate with the providers. And even if you don't have a solution, communicate that you don't have a solution or offer alternatives. Oftentimes, I think when that disruption happens and you offer a substitute that may not be yours, that may be a competitor, you will see that the organization comes back to you because you've built that trust and that partnership with them. Of transparency and solutioning.
That's a huge statement, and I couldn't agree with you more. It's been certainly a year or two of building trust. With the suppliers you have is important. The ones you don't have yet, or may have helped you out, maybe they're the next. Maybe they get a position with you, which is fantastic. Amanda, it sounds like I made a note here. You found a home. It sounds like you enjoy what you're doing and love what you're doing. And people obviously enjoy the success that you've had at Stanford. And I'm so happy to have this conversation with you today.
Thank you. And it's an honor to speak with many of you or all of you and really share perspective. It's one perspective, I'm sure, of many out there. And I think there's an aspect of continuous improvement and how we continue to collaborate and transform the way we operate, which excites me.
Thank you, Amanda. Have a great
All right. Thank you.
Okay.